Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Governor Rick Scott offers to share the Florida Supreme Court appointment process with his potential successor, but some observers see the move as self-serving.
So he's offering to share something that's not his, which is a rather strange position to take.
Also this week, a legal fight over Miami Beach's minimum wage could have far-reaching impacts.
That would open the door for 67 counties and 412 cities to adopt their own ordinances.
We'll also follow fights on medical marijuana, a constitutional amendment that would automatically restore voting rights to most felony convicts in Florida, and attend a tribute to the state's missing children and those who work heroically to rescue them and prevent them from being taken in the first place. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. While most eyes were on the U.S. Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh in Washington this week, there was a far less publicized Supreme Court drama taking place in Florida. Governor Rick Scott's decision to start the process of appointing new Florida Supreme Court justices has ignited a looming constitutional crisis. Lynn Hatter reports that the center of the issue is who, the outgoing or incoming governor, has the authority to make those appointments.
Here's the dilemma. State Supreme Court Justices Peggy Quince, Fred Lewis, and Barbara Pariente have reached the mandatory retirement age of 70, and their terms on the court expire the same day Florida will swear in a new governor. The state's constitution does not say who, whether the outgoing or incoming governor, gets to name those new justices. This has only happened once before, and to one justice, Peggy Quince, who happens to be in the situation twice.
Buddy McKay actually may have been in office by the time this happened, but it was during the end of the Childs administration. And I think people of goodwill just sat down and figured it out.
Sandy Dallenberg is one of the leading experts on Florida constitutional law. He's a former bar president, former state representative, and president emeritus of Florida State University. The deal between a Democrat and a Republican paved the way for Quince to become the first Black woman on the Florida Supreme Court. Now she, along with Pariente, Lewis, and the rest of the court, may have to decide the matter of who gets to choose their successors.
And as you go down the track that you've started, we now get to Inauguration Day. As you've already pointed out, that's the day the judge's terms end. So that's when the vacancy occurs. As I read the Constitution, you don't have a nominating commission until you have a vacancy.
This conundrum has been a long time coming. There was an attempt to address the issue in 2014 through a constitutional amendment. It would have given that power to the sitting governor, but critics blasted it as a power grab and voters rejected it. Last year, the League of Women Voters, along with the government watchdog group Common Cause, brought the issue to the Florida Supreme Court. But the justices didn't rule. Instead, they said the issue wasn't, quote, ripe for consideration at the time. But Dallenberg says an attorney for the governor's office during oral arguments for the case made a few admissions he says point to who gets the appointments.
They seem to concede that the issue needs to be settled, which I think everybody would agree to. And number two, I think he conceded that a declaratory judgments action would be an appropriate way to settle the issue. So we have governor's counsel saying is not clear.
The matter could come down to timing. See, Governor Rick Scott believes the justices' terms end at midnight on January 8th. A new governor isn't usually sworn in until later in the day, around noon. And that gives Scott the ability to make the appointments in his remaining hours on the job. Dallenberg says there's case law that argues the justices' time expires at the end of the day. when a new governor is sitting in that office. Scott says he wants his successor to help interview finalists in the hopes of reaching a deal, just like Lawton Childs and Jeb Bush did.
So he's offering to share something that's not his, which is a rather strange position to take, but that's where he is right now, as I understand it.
Sharing could be simple if Ron DeSantis, a fellow Republican, is the winner. But if it's Democrat Andrew Gillum, well, a deal could be harder to reach. Scott recently called on the state's Judicial Nominating Commission to open up the application process, and it has 60 days to come up with a list of candidates for each of the Florida Supreme Court's looming vacancies. If the court did not consider the matter ripe before, it may well be now. The president of the League of Women Voters of Florida says her group is considering refiling its lawsuit. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
The city of Miami Beach is in a battle with the state that could impact hundreds of Florida municipalities. Gina Jordan tells us it's about home rule and the city's ability to set its own policy when it comes to wages.
Florida's minimum wage is $8.25 an hour. The amount may go up each year based on changes in the Consumer Price Index. Assistant City Attorney Rob Rosenwald says Miami Beach leaders voted 2 years ago to approve a higher minimum wage than the state.
In Miami Beach, where the cost of living is higher, our workforce suffers exponentially higher. So the City of Miami Beach City Commission decided in 2016 that it was only fair to give a raise to the lowest wage workers in our city.
A circuit judge overturned the city's ordinance, and an appeals court agreed the state's preemption law does not allow the city to set its own minimum wage.
In 2003, the legislature passed a law that said no local government may have a local minimum wage higher than the federal minimum wage. In immediate response to that, within 60 days, folks had started gathering signatures to pass a constitutional initiative that raised the minimum wage from the federal level and created a statewide minimum wage, and also said that it did not preempt or limit the authority of any other public body to mandate a higher minimum wage.
So which rule takes precedence, the 2003 state law or the 2004 constitutional amendment? The Florida Supreme Court has agreed to take up the case. Rosenwald says the city has asked the court for a decision by January 1st because workers are overdue for a bigger paycheck.
They were supposed to get a raise to $10.31 an hour starting on January 1st of 2018, and now coming up on January 1st of 2019, they are slated to get an increase to $11.31 an hour.
Craig Kahn, general counsel for the Florida League of Cities, says this case comes down to how the justices interpret the law.
We believe with the adoption of the constitutional amendment, that had the effect of nullifying the state preemption from 2003.
So why did lawmakers feel the need to pass that bill in 2003? Do you know?
Some cities and some counties, not a lot, had adopted minimum wage ordinances, living wage ordinances for their own employees. They did not impose these on private employers. However, there were a number of other cities, primarily in California, that had adopted minimum wage or living wage ordinances that applied to private employers. And we understood the concern from the Florida legislature in 2003, even though that issue did not exist in Florida. They wanted to cut the issue off at the knees and not even give it an opportunity for a city or a county to adopt an ordinance that would have a minimum wage for private employers.
So Miami Beach city attorneys recently filed a legal brief asking the Supreme Court to issue a ruling by January 1st so they can put this ordinance that they passed into action quickly. The league signed on to file a friend of the court brief in support. Why did you guys feel like you should sign on as a friend of the court in this case?
The core foundation of the Florida League of Cities is to protect municipal home rule powers, and that's the power of local decision makers to address local problems. The actions of the citizenry in 2004 to adopt the constitutional amendment, the actions of the city of Miami in 2016 to adopt their minimum wage ordinance. That all is part and parcel and fundamental to the league's core value, and that is if cities believe that there are problems that exist within their communities, that city officials, city elected officials, should have the authority to address those local problems through their local decision-making process and address the needs of their constituents.
So this comes down to a home rule issue, and it could impact other municipalities that say it's expensive to live in our city, we need to boost the minimum wage. So this really could impact other areas of Florida.
Yes. If the Florida Supreme Court rules that the constitutional amendment prevails over the prior legislative preemption, then that would open the door for 67 counties and 412 cities to adopt their own ordinances. Now, I'm not suggesting that all would, but the authority would exist for them to take that action if they so desired.
Craig Kahn with the Florida League of Cities says the league will file its brief by September 21st. Business groups that challenge the legality of the Miami Beach Ordinance include the Florida Retail Federation, the Florida Chamber of Commerce, and the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. They oppose the additional mandate on local businesses. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Gina Jordan.
Still to come on Capitol Report, the federal government's medical marijuana policy is still largely unclear, and it's affecting state governments and private businesses.
It's pretty simple. The medical marijuana dispensary, you know, as one, as a business, then you start getting into other things, and we don't know the answers to these questions.
Florida's archaic and what many say is a flawed clemency process comes under national scrutiny ahead of a November ballot initiative that could change it drastically.
The worst state of all concerning this and arguably everything else is Florida.
And Florida remembers the state's missing children and recognizes heroic efforts.
Today is a day to honor the families of Florida's missing children. We honor all of Florida's children who were forever taken from us, and the children who have yet to come home.
The legality of medical marijuana is still largely a gray area in the eyes of the federal government. Sean Mulcahy reports the confusion impacting banks, dispensaries, and policy is leading some, like Democratic Agricultural Commissioner candidate Nikki Fried, to call for reform.
31 states and the District of Columbia have some form of legalized marijuana. In 2015, Florida joined the ranks when more than 70% of residents gave the nod for medicinal use. But despite growing support, marijuana is still illegal under federal law, and the federal government has shown reluctance to adopt policies that reconcile the conflict. The problem was recently highlighted in August when Florida Agricultural Commissioner candidate Nikki Fried got word that Wells Fargo was closing her campaign account. Fried advocates for expanding the state's medical marijuana industry. The bank cited its policy to, quote, not knowingly bank or provide services to marijuana businesses or for activities related to those businesses.
It was just a campaign, but based on that, we are moving all accounts.
Where to?
BB&T.
That seemed to be the end of the story until last week when BB&T said they too were closing the Fried campaign's account. Now, she argues she's being targeted.
And I wonder how many other accounts that they are not looking at, that we know that across the country that there are marijuana, there are candidates out there that are supporting advocacy for medical purposes, and they haven't shut down their accounts, or any of the law firms or any of the other lobbying shops that have clients for medical marijuana. I was specifically targeted.
But that's not the case, says Anthony DeMarco. He's the executive vice president of government affairs at the Florida Bankers Association.
Well, this is the first I've heard of something like that. Was the first time. But I'm sure the banks are just very concerned that the potential fallout from all that with the regulators.
DeMarco says there's just too much at stake, and financial institutions are unwilling to take the risk.
If I was a banker and I owned a bank or the president of a bank, I would not be involved in this just because of there is so much potential liability, legal liability, and just the cost of compliance, that it wouldn't be worth my time.
But Fried argues she's done nothing but voice support for marijuana.
I am not touching the plant. I am not selling the plant. I'm not producing the plant. I'm simply advocating for the expansion of medical marijuana, and that was the reason for closing me down.
Other candidates have done the same thing. Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz is a vocal supporter of federal medical marijuana legislation. And according to state records, the dispensary Surterra has given over $350,000 to Florida campaigns this election cycle alone. So why is Freed's account the only one that's been closed?
The bank may have happened to notice it because of her position, but I don't know the answer to that.
DeMarco says other campaigns could face similar outcomes unless the federal government takes action. Freed joined Democratic Congressman Charlie Crist Monday to support a bill that would do just that.
In Congress, I'm proud to co-sponsor the bill that helps fix this, making it clear that financial institutions will not be punished for serving legitimate marijuana-related businesses.
Crist argues the lack of a coherent policy not only impacts those in the industry, but also hurts patients' access to reliable care. Another solution Freed has floated is starting a state bank to house marijuana money.
This is something that I would hope that the cabinet, the governor's office, the attorney general would fight on our behalf. So if we have a state charter bank that has jeopardy of having any type of replication from the federal government, that they would stand up and defend these banks against any actions on the federal level.
Freed's opponent, Republican State Representative Matt Caldwell, takes a similar position on medical marijuana. He supports expanding access to patients and increasing the number of licensed growers and retailers throughout the state. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sean Mulcahy.
Has Governor Rick Scott's cabinet met for its last clemency board meeting before the state's general election, the conversation surrounding felon voting rights is ramping up. Ryan Daly reports one amendment on the ballot could put a new restoration system in place.
In the last few months, a federal district judge declared the state system unconstitutional, taking issue with the discretion it leaves the governor's cabinet to grant clemency. Judge Mark Walker ordered an overhaul, but a higher court granted a stay on the decision, leaving change uncertain in the meantime. Amendment 4, which made its way to the ballot by way of Citizens Initiative, could change all that. It would automatically restore voting rights for felons.
And we have a chance, November 6th, to restore that right, that opportunity, at dignity for all Floridians.
That's Democratic gubernatorial candidate Andrew Gillum at a rally for Amendment 4 when he spoke alongside Al Sharpton. Calls for an overhaul of Florida's current voting rights restoration system are not new to Floridians. They are, however, garnering attention at the national level. Comedian John Oliver hosts HBO's Last Week Tonight. He implored Florida's voters in his most recent episode to support Amendment 4.
This November, Florida, you have got a real chance to remedy a mistake and do something genuinely good for over a million of your citizens.
At its last meeting before the November election, the issue of people with a felony in their past voting illegally came up several times with applicants. Some say they did so unwittingly, like Scott Friedman in this exchange with Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam.
Why did you vote illegally 12 times?
I shouldn't answer because I thought y'all might need my vote. Shouldn't answer that.
Wouldn't recommend it.
Then I won't. I didn't know I was voting illegally.
Until votes are cast, many who go before the board may feel, as this applicant did, at the mercy of the cabinet.
Oh, I really don't know what to say. I'm at your mercy. I'm not the person that I used to be.
The next meeting of the clemency board will be December 5th. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
On Capitol Report, Ryan Daly joins us. And Ryan, you've been following a lot of the constitutional amendment issues that have been bouncing around here in anticipation of the November election. And most of our attention, I think, has been kind of focused on what the Constitution Revision Commission had teed up as far as amendments that people would vote on. And many of those have gotten knocked off the ballot through court challenges. But not all of the amendments came from the CRC. There were some other ones, and you've been following one of those in particular, right?
Correct. Yeah, that is Amendment 4, and that made its way to the ballot by way of Citizens Initiative. The group that has been behind that for some time is Floridians for a Fair Democracy. They say they got 1.1 million petitions together. They needed 840,000 over 15 congressional districts. This thing is on the ballot, and it is getting big-time support, and the conversation surrounding it has really ramped up.
So let's say on November 6th, the people of Florida go to the polls and they vote in favor of Amendment 4. What happens then, Ryan?
Amendment 4 is going to automatically restore voting rights for people re-entering society after a felony, rather than leave it to chance convincing the clemency board that you deserve your rights back. This week you had, at the national level, you had comedian John Oliver talk about it at length on his show Last Week Tonight on HBO. As one Tampa Bay Times reporter, Emily Mahoney, put it, I believe she said, it was getting the John Oliver treatment. If you were to have tuned in to the clemency board meeting this week, you can tell it's this very, very emotional process for some people where they've been waiting. They have all their eggs into this basket. You know, they look forward to this meeting. They can get denied having their rights given back.
Part of the problem also seems to be, Ryan, that whereas in some previous administrations, there were a lot of cases being handled by the clemency process. In recent years, under Governor Rick Scott, there have not been as many, leading some folks to say, well, this isn't fair because we're not processing as many people as we were heretofore.
Right. Actually, in Charlie Crist, who had amended the whole process prior to Rick Scott getting in office and kind of putting more barriers up, he wrote an op-ed last year. He said in his own words that they put more than 155,000 Floridians restored through their process in 4 years. That number has dropped dramatically. I mean, you're talking about a handful of thousands of people under Rick Scott's administration. Again, the clemency board is made up of his cabinet. So I think it's just a process that people who have been disenfranchised and people who are casual observers are kind of frustrated with, because they see how just the logistics of it. You have these meetings every so often. People tell the clemency board what they've been doing with their lives, how they've been rehabilitated, etc. And even then, federal district judge Mark Walker's criticism of the process is that it leaves the cabinet with unfettered discretion, I believe were his words. I think that's where you see so much of the support come in for this amendment, is people look at the process and they say, you've got a million plus people who don't have their voting rights. They've served their time. And you hear it from these people in these meetings. There are a lot of tears. It's a long and arduous process. And by the time they get up to Tallahassee, if they're coming from South Florida, you can see and hear in their voices that they've served their time. The amendment does not apply to those convicted of a murder or felony sexual offenses. So I think that's something that people who are apprehensive about voting for the amendment, that might soften it for them, that what's generally considered the worst of the worst crimes would not fall under this. But there are a laundry list of lesser felony offenses. So if you commit one of those, you do your time. If Amendment 4 passes, once you get out, you are getting your right to vote restored.
Okay, a good explanation of what's going on with Amendment 4, which is something we are going to be voting on here come November 6th. Florida Public Radio's Ryan Daly. Thanks, Ryan.
All right, thanks a lot.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, September 10th marked the 20th annual Florida Missing Children's Day. As Sasha Cordner reports, it was not only a time to remember those still missing and those forever gone, but also the day honors the state's efforts.
We remember the children, those whose lives have been taken, and those who are missing.
Each year, Florida Department of Law Enforcement Commissioner Rick Swearingen and other officials take the time to remember the state's missing children.
The Missing Children's Day serves as a day of remembrance. It is also a day of hope. It's a day to recognize how Floridians are fighting to bring our missing children home and make child abduction a thing of the past. As the first state to institute a missing persons clearinghouse in 1982, Florida led the way in creating a nationwide standard for effectively handling missing persons cases.
And Swearengen says his agency has made strides in returning kids safely home. That includes issuing missing child alerts as well as Amber alerts when there's a clear indication the child has been abducted.
In 2017, FDLE's Missing and Endangered Persons Information Clearinghouse issued 10 Amber alerts and 51 missing child alerts. 14 of those alerts were directly responsible for the safe recovery of those children. In addition, Florida has now certified its 7th Child Abduction Response Team, also known as CART. Currently, there are 23 CARTs nationwide. Florida has 7 of them, making our state the model in rapid response for critical emergency search activations.
During this year's ceremony of the 20th annual Florida Missing Children's Day, several kids won awards for their efforts to help other children. Denham Rain with West Gadsden Middle School also won this year's essay contest called This Is How I Stay Safe All Day.
To start with, make sure you know your parents' contact information. Cling your address, parents' phone names, and phone numbers. I can't tell you how many times I've talked to kids who don't even know their parents' phone number. Some say they have it locked into their phone, but if you don't have your phone, then you don't really have anything to go on. It's good to at least know one good number.
And the awards didn't stop there. A couple adult Florida citizens were also honored for making strides in advocating for at-risk youth and on behalf of victims. But a majority of the awards went to law enforcement officers across the state. They included Detective Bernadette Marr, recognized for her efforts to combat human trafficking. She's part of a new human trafficking task force for the Miami Beach Police Department. Donna Uzel is FDLE's special agent in charge. She says because of Marr's hard work, dozens of dangerous criminals are off the streets and a number of underage victims are safe.
Detective Marr is responsible for 45% of the arrests made in all of the 2017 human trafficking cases prosecuted by the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office. From January of 2017 to April of this year, Detective Marr's investigations have led to the arrest, and listen to this, of over 40 human trafficking suspects, each with at least one victim in their company.
When looking at calls to the National Human Trafficking Hotline and prosecutions, Florida ranks 3rd in the nation for human trafficking. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Sean Mulcahy. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FBR Cap Report. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol. Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.